From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
A lot of the comedy that was going on when we started out seemed pretty tame and boring. You know, it was all part of the punk rock days. We just wanted to see if there was a way to shake up what sketch comedy was a little.
That's Dave Foley, one of the members of the Canadian sketch comedy troupe The Kids in the Hall. Today, we'll find out how the kids shook up the world of television sketch comedy. Also, is television responsible for the decline and fall of culture?
Television is not to blame for it. Television is merely one of the things to which we turn in order to numb ourselves to a kind of psychic pain that we live with every day.
And a writer for the sitcom Frasier talks about his new novel.
And attempting to have it both ways, to have his cake and eat it too, and you could change a bobble and cake, he finds himself getting in a lot of trouble.
That's the main title theme from the ABC television program Lost. According to Stephen Johnson, watching Lost and other TV shows is good for our brains. Johnson is the author of Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. Johnson told Anne Strainchamps how watching today's television is actually making us smarter.
If you look at the history of television over the last 30 years, what you find, if you look at it from this angle, is that the story is actually one of increased complexity, not a kind of race to the bottom the way we conventionally hear. The plot lines are much more complicated. The number of characters per show is much higher. And there's much less kind of hand-holding by the creators of the show. There's kind of an assumption of a more sophisticated audience out there.
You actually break this down some by talking about some specific kind of narrative techniques that TV shows are using now. So maybe we could talk about some of those. For instance, this concept you call multiple threading.
Yeah, this is actually, it's an interesting concept because it evolves in a sense out of the soap opera. And in a way, it dates back to kind of the great 19th century novels, which had the same kind of technique. But it was something that was not common on television shows in the kind of the 50s or the 60s or even the 70s, where you have a given episode that might have 6 or 8 or 10 separate kind of coherent narratives that are running through the episode. In fact, sometimes run through an entire season or a series of seasons. And, you know, a great example of this that I talk about in the book is The Sopranos. I mean, every episode of The Sopranos will often force you to kind of follow, you know, sometimes as many as a dozen different threads. There's something happening with Tony, there's something happening at work, there's something happening with Carmela. There are all these different kind of plot lines that are woven throughout the storyline. Now, what's interesting, if you go back and look at one of the first kind of mainstream primetime shows to really introduce this kind of multiple threading was the show Hill Street Blues in the early 80s. And Hill Street actually was a less complicated show than your average episode of The Sopranos, but it was the most complicated show on television in the early 80s.
And it was considered a real breakthrough show, right?
Yeah, and it was a fantastic show, and it had, you know, a lot of promotion from NBC when it first aired. It had the best reviews of any show on television that year, and I believe it was 1981, and yet it finished basically dead last in the ratings. And all the test screenings that they did, the audiences continually said, this show is too complicated. We can't follow all these plots or too many characters. There's too much going on.
Because everybody was just used to Dragnet?
Yeah, no, exactly. Basically, they were used to, you know, shows that, you know, were much more kind of crude in their storytelling techniques. They were used to Happy Days and Three's Company and as you said, Dragnet and Quincy and all these shows that we kind of forget about.
Shows in which the whole story is there in that one half hour. You know, you don't ever have to see another one and you don't have to have seen anything beforehand to make sense of that one half hour, right?
Exactly. There's this kind of internal coherence to each episode where if you've never seen the show before, they'll explain it all to you. You might have to understand that these two people are brothers maybe, but besides that, they'll explain everything. Compare that, you know, to a huge hit show like Lost, you know, which almost single-handedly with Desperate Housewives kind of converted ABC into a struggling third-place network into a real kind of powerhouse. Now, Lost has any given episode, I mean, if you count it out right now, there are probably about 60 different kind of open mysteries and unexplained things happening. And there's just an expectation now that the audience is willing to put up with that kind of complexity and all that mystery and all these plot points that date back, you know, 20 episodes, you have to remember this one little detail from 20 episodes ago that, you know, most people would have completely forgotten, but people are actually able to keep all that in their mind and track all these different narrative events.
Do you think the audience just tolerates that because that's what we're given these days? Or do you think actually audiences have gotten smarter? They can follow all of this now.
There's no question in my mind that audiences have gotten smarter at following these types of stories. They're being offered these things because I think that it's clear that there's a demand for them, and that if you've tried to put on Three's Company today or The Love Boat, people would say, well, this show is just way too simple. It's not interesting and stimulating and challenging. The question is, does that kind of intelligence that comes from being able to track a complicated television show, is that a useful form of intelligence that you can transfer to other parts of your life?
You know, are you still smarter when the TV is off?
Yeah, exactly. It could just be that we are training people to just watch television better, which, you know, is entirely possible. But clearly something has changed in the kind of popular mind's ability to take in these more complicated storytellings via the television. You know, if you'd put Lost on the air 25 years ago, nobody would have watched it. It just would have been far too complicated.
You could also suggest that the networks have simply gotten very smart at figuring out ways to make us watch the entire season, since otherwise you don't have a hope of understanding what's going on.
Well, I would take it even a step further and say what they've figured out is how to make programs, because there's a very strong economic incentive for this. They figured out a way to make programs that are interesting to watch multiple times. And that's one of the key economic drivers of this, because people often ask me, you know, why, if the shows are getting more complex, why are they getting more complex? You know, I thought everything was being dumbed down and there was this race to the bottom. But in fact, what's changed in the market now because of DVDs, because of the internet kind of selling of these shows, because of syndication, there's a huge economic payoff if you can make a show that's interesting to watch three or four times, because people will want to watch it in syndication. People will want to buy the DVD and watch it over. That's why shows like Sopranos do very well in terms of DVD sales. That's why shows like Seinfeld and The Simpsons, hugely complicated, you know, for sitcom standards, comedy shows, have made so much money in syndication. So there's an economic incentive to make something that's more complex. It isn't just kind of boring to watch a second time because everything is so obvious.
Yeah, you give another example of that, a scene in ER, I think, where, again, you have to have remembered something that happened a couple of episodes back to get the significance of the moment.
Yeah, I call this in the book the idea of flashing arrows, which is actually a reference to this kind of mock horror film from the 80s that at one point had a scene where the babysitter leaves the door unlocked and the camera zooms in on the door that's been unlocked, and then it zooms in again, and then there's a little flashing arrow that appears on the screen saying, door unlocked, making fun of the kind of conventions of Hollywood kind of slasher films. And, you know, they're not always that obvious, but if you go back and watch something like Dallas or something like that from the late 70s, you'll see that the shows are made as if the creators think that the audience is slightly, you know, kind of mentally challenged. You know, every little moment they'll say, you know, make it very clear, these two people are brothers. Does everybody understand that? You know, can we, is this clear to everyone before we move on to this next point? And nowadays, the shows just kind of roll out these incredibly intricate plots without a lot of hand-holding. So if you look at an average scene of from The West Wing or from ER, there's just an amazing kind of speed to the dialogue and to the plotting without a lot of those flashing arrows. You know, the other great example of that in a show like Lost is the very structure of Lost itself, which if they'd done it 20 years ago, they would have had, you know, this kind of predictable airplane crash format where you would have met all the characters on the plane. You would have met the pilot and the stewardess and the nun and the little boy who's traveling alone and all the different, you know, kind of stock characters. And you would meet all these people and learn their backstory, and then the plane would crash, and then you would see what happens to them on the island. Instead, the creators of Lost did something very smart but very bold, which is that they started the whole series the second after the plane crashes. And every single character you meet is a complete mystery. You just basically know nothing about these people. And the whole course of the first two seasons has been slowly revealing all this kind of web of connections between all these people, but most of them are still largely mysteries to us. And an audience from 20 years ago just wouldn't have tolerated that level of ambiguity. They would have said, who are all these people? You have to introduce me to these characters so I can make sense of this. But now we kind of embrace that, and it's a huge runaway international hit show.
What do you think has changed? I mean, why do you think viewers are able to not only follow all these plots, but are actually sort of demanding these kinds of puzzle plots?
Well, I think, first off, that it gets to this basic assumption that a lot of us have, that we're all basically innate slackers and that we just want to sit down in front of the television and zone out and not pay any attention. I think that's just wrong. I think people do like to be challenged, and people do like to, you know, have interesting experiences that cause them to think and that provoke them. It's just that we were only given unchallenging things before. But the other thing that's happened is I think that we've been slowly, in a sense, we've been being kind of trained over the last 20 or 30 years as the shows get, you know, increasingly complicated. So Hill Street comes out, and that's a complicated show, much more complicated than anything before it, and we slowly kind of get used to that. And then we have, you know, a show like Twin Peaks comes out, and then you have Seinfeld and The Simpsons in comedy, and then The West Wing. And over time, we get better and better at kind of handling these things. And in some ways, it's not unlike the structure of video games, which are designed to kind of start out easy, and then over time, they get more and more difficult as you play them. And by the end of, you know, the 40 hours of playing a video game, you end up quite good at doing all these things that you were incompetent at when you first started playing the game.
We've been talking about what you could call the cream of the crop of television shows, you know, the literary sorts of things, Sopranos, ER, Six Feet Under, Lost. That's actually not so much what critics complain about when they talk about the dumbing down of the entertainment industry. I mean, what about shows like Survivor, Joe Millionaire, all the reality shows? I mean, do you see any redeeming qualities in those?
Well, it gets to this question of the trend. What is the trend, right? And, you know, I certainly am not the biggest fan of reality programming, and I think there's probably too much of it on the air, and we've gone through a little bit of a phase where reality TV seems to be ubiquitous. But you have to compare it to where we were 20 or 30 years ago. And reality programming is effectively a game show, right? I mean, it's a bunch of contestants who are sitting around vying for prizes in an artificial environment, but doing it in a relatively unscripted manner. They're making up their strategies and acting kind of in improvisational ways to try and win these prizes. So the question is, to me, you know, if this is the kind of evolution, the latest evolution of the game show genre, what's the trend? Which is more complicated, The Price is Right and Wheel of Fortune or Survivor and The Apprentice? And I think anybody who's watched any of those shows would have to say that Survivor and The Apprentice are much more complicated. There's a lot of psychological strategy that goes into winning a game like Survivor. The Apprentice, people play along and think about the various different strategies of the characters, and, you know, they talk about the different ethical issues that come up as these games unfold. And it's all sort of frivolous, but it's certainly much more complex than sitting around guessing the price of a refrigerator, which is what we used to do on The Price is Right.
Stephen Johnson is the author of Everything Bad is Good for You: How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs. And this is music from one of the TV shows Johnson talked about, Lost. If you have thoughts about whether TV is smartening us up or dumbing us down, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the impact of television on the American novel, and an American novel by a television writer, as we continue to look at TV. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Joe Keenan leads two literary lives. For 7 years, he served as a writer-producer for the TV show Frasier. During that time, Keenan won Emmys and Writers Guild Awards for his work. And Joe Keenan is also a novelist. His latest book is called My Lucky Star. It's set in a town that he knows well, Hollywood. Here's Joe Keenan reading an excerpt from My Lucky Star.
It is never a happy moment in the life of a struggling artist when some fresh assault on his fragile dignity compels him finally and painfully to concede that failure has lost its charm. He has, up until this point, soldiered bravely along, managing to persuade himself that there's something not merely noble, but downright jolly about struggle, about demeaning temp jobs, day-old baked goods and pitchers of beer nursed like dying pets into the night. He would, of course, grant that La Vie Boheme, with its myriad deprivations and anxieties, was not an unalloyed delight, but whenever its indignities rankled unduly, he could console himself with his certainty that Bohemia was not, after all, his permanent address. Oh no. His present, charmingly scruffy existence was a mere preamble to his real life, a larval stage from which he would soon gloriously emerge into the sunshine of success. Its small embarrassments were, if anything, to be prized not only for their lessons in humility, but for the many droll, self-deprecatory anecdotes they would later provide, stories he'd polish and trot out for parties, interviews, and, why be pessimistic, talk shows. Then, one day, he is faced with some final affront, minor perhaps, but so symbolically freighted as to land on him with the force of an inadequately cabled Steinway. He reels, stunned, and dark speculations, long and successfully repressed, rampage through his mind. For the first time, he allows himself to wonder if his life 20 years hence will be any different than his present existence. Of course it will be different, coos the voice in his head. You'll be old. From this icy thought, a short road leads to panic, and from panic to despair, self-pity, desperation, and finally, Los Angeles.
Joe Keenan told Steve Paulson about his latest novel.
It's a comedy and a very twisty tale about three wannabe young screenwriters who find themselves embroiled in the very messy, escalating feud between rival factions of a Hollywood acting dynasty, the Malenfant family. The story kicks off when Philip, who is my narrator, a struggling New York playwright, gets a phone call from his best friend Gilbert, who is off in Los Angeles mooching off his mother and her new fiancé, a very rich studio mogul. And Gilbert tells Philip that he and his writing partner Claire have to drop everything immediately and fly to Los Angeles because he's gotten this fantastic lucrative gig adapting a novel into a screenplay for this rich Hollywood producer. Philip and Claire, given their past experiences with Gilbert, are deeply suspicious of this because they know that Gilbert, you know, is very work-averse, is prone to get-rich-quick schemes, and he's a young man whose scruples cannot be glimpsed without the aid of a particle accelerator. But they get on the plane anyway, and they fly to California, and sure enough, the whole thing is way, way too good to be true. The first thing they discover is that the book they've been asked to adapt is this horribly sappy World War II melodrama that Philip refers to as one of those ruthlessly sentimental books that make you feel as if your heartstrings are being plucked with a lug wrench. On page after page, it strains to achieve uplift, and in the case of My Dinner, damn near succeeded. And if that isn't bad enough, they find that Gilbert has obtained this job through an insanely audacious act of plagiarism, one that they're sure will be discovered any day. But as they're reeling from this news, word arrives that this project improbably is going to be graced by the two biggest stars in Hollywood, the legendary screen diva Diana Malenfant, a two-time Oscar winner, pushing 70, and her even more famous son, Stephen, who is the biggest action star in Hollywood. Mother and son have not acted together since Stephen's debut at the age of 10, 25 years ago. And this is very bad news for our heroes because there's no way stars of that magnitude are going to let three nobodies write their long-awaited reunion picture. But Gilbert, being Gilbert, manages to wangle a courtesy meeting for them to pitch themselves for the job. And they arrive at this meeting to find Diana's household in a great uproar because word has just arrived for them that Diana's sister, the washed-up Lily, is planning to write a scathing tell-all memoir, and both Diana and Stephen are up in arms about this and terrified of what Lily is going to say about them because, washed up or not, she knows all the family dirt, including the fact that Stephen, although married, is secretly gay. And it's at this point that Philip, walking into the situation and desperate to win Stephen's approval and to win the job, comes up with an interesting solution to their problem. He says, if you will hire us to write the screenplay, I will pull double duty as Lily's ghostwriter, giving you a spy and an agent of influence in the enemy camp. And so they agree to this bargain, and Philip begins a double life as Lily's ghostwriter and the screenwriter for the next project for Diana and Stephen. But things, of course, get rather complicated from then on. And if that sounds like a lot of story, believe me, that's the tip of the iceberg. That's just setup. We're barely four or five chapters in at that point.
Right. Now, you mentioned that Stephen, this huge action star in Hollywood, is secretly gay. And that's clearly an idea that you're playing with in this story. And it raises the obvious question, is homophobia a major problem in Hollywood?
I don't think homophobia is nearly the problem that it once was in Hollywood. I mean, there are so many out gay people having amazing careers, from David Geffen to Elton John to Ian McKellen. I mean, there are only certain positions in which being gay is a big problem. And I think the male action star is in some ways the last bastion of the closet. You can be a character actor and be pretty open about your sexuality. But people who want to be very big stars and, you know, star in, you know, $150 million movies, the studio is very, very leery about alienating the core audience for those movies, which is, you know, young men 13 to 24 years old who will go and see these movies, you know, 4 and 5 times at the multiplex and help them earn $500 million. And so if you were a closeted action star, you will think twice before daring to be frank about your sexuality. But you have a character, Stephen, who is, you know, is enormously frustrated at having to live a lie and wants to have it both ways, wants to, you know, have the public image and have the marriage and have the stardom, but who wants to fool around on the side as discreetly as possible. And in attempting to have it both ways, to have his cake and eat it too, and you could change a vowel in cake, he finds himself getting in a lot of trouble. Philip, in attempting to safeguard, it's a curious undertaking that Philip takes for himself in this book, because where he's done things a little bit more heroic, he's basically signing on to help, you know, a closeted male action star stay closeted, but his attempts to stand sentry duty at the door to Stephen's closet go disastrously awry, and he winds up dragging him into a potentially career-ending scandal, into a sexual sting that puts him in a position that goes beyond merely scandalous to, you know, utterly humiliating, you know, a scandal that if it broke would not only end his career but would make him a global punchline.
Now, it's worth pointing out that you are not only a novelist, you've also worked as a writer-producer for the sitcom Frasier, and now you're the co-creator of the current sitcom Out of Practice, and you are gay. And I'm curious about whether you feel like you have to hide your sexuality at all.
Well, I couldn't if I tried. But I've never felt in Hollywood that I've had to hide my sexuality. When I joined the staff of Frasier, one of the co-creators of Frasier, David Lee, is an openly gay man, and there were a couple of gay writers on the staff. So I missed the period back, say, in the 70s and perhaps into the 80s, where being open about your sexuality was a liability if you were a behind-the-camera kind of person. If you were a writer, I mean, they basically only cared about funny. And I kind of brought, you know, what some people would call a slightly gay sensibility, or at any rate, gay themes to Frasier. The first episode that I wrote for them was a farce called The Matchmaker, in which Frasier invites the station manager home to set up with his housekeeper, Daphne, his dad's physical therapist. And thanks to Frasier's conversation, which naturally strays towards men's fashion and culture and opera and theater, the guy assumes that he is on a date with Frasier. And the fun of the farce was managing to sustain this misapprehension for the longest possible time and to build on it and to escalate it, to have him at some point assuming. At one point, Frasier says, so you're cool living with your father? I mean, you don't find that cramps your style? And Frasier replies, well, the only problem is when I bring my dates home and the dad tries to steal him, he quips. And so the guy now thinks that Martin is gay as well, and he's stumbled upon this odd gay father and gay son living together. But you just keep building a situation farcically like that. And I did a couple of other episodes of Frasier that explored, you know, gay themes and subject matter in a very lighthearted, very farcical way.
Well, do you feel like Frasier broke new ground? Because it certainly was willing to poke fun at images of masculinity. And a lot of people have said this is a, you know, one of those rare sitcoms, especially back when it first came on, that had a gay sensibility.
I really honestly don't quite know what a gay sensibility is. It's like the definition of obscenity. You can't quite define it, but you know it when you see it. I think that Frasier and Niles were metrosexuals before that term had actually come into being. But, you know, when that was coined perhaps, you know, 5 or 6 years after the show debuted, everybody could say, oh, yes, that's what they are. They're straight guys who behave sometimes like gay men and have very little anxiety about their masculinity being questioned, who sort of follow their own drummer and like what they like and enjoy what they enjoy and don't really give a damn if people presuppose this makes them gay men.
Well, I want to get back to your new novel, My Lucky Star, which is a very cynical take on Hollywood, I have to say. The reason that Gilbert and Philip get this screenplay approved is that Gilbert passed off a script that he said he wrote, plagiarized, and I mean, it's Casablanca.
And, yes, it's Casablanca. Well, Gilbert finds himself at a dinner party with somebody who's looking for a World War II script, and he, of course, pipes up that he has one, and then, you know, thinks somehow he's going to come up with a brilliant spec script in a matter of days when he has never, in fact, in his life finished anything longer than a haiku. And so he realizes, well, if this guy needs a brilliant spec script, I could always pass off Casablanca because it's particularly rather vulgar, you know, producer has bragged at one point in the evening that while all of his contemporaries are, you know, slaves at the temple of cinema, he has himself, in fact, never seen a black and white movie. So Gilbert knows he's rather safe in passing this off just to this one person. But that's Gilbert's character. Gilbert is a con artist. You know, he's very fond of chicanery and he will do anything. I mean, he's is completely, as I said, without scruple when it comes to his objectives. And his objectives was to get this job. And he knew if that would get me the job, fine. And then he's going to very generously put his friend's name on the script because he knows there's no way he's going to actually be able to do the job by himself. So he recruits his friends as co-authors of this plagiarized script and invites them out, not telling them that it's Casablanca, because he knows that Claire's ethical sense would never permit her to be a party to plagiarism. So he, of course, lies to his friends, he lies to the producer, gets everybody together, gets them the job, and it's only when they're in the producer's office and Claire is asking, would you mind citing some favorite scenes from that script? Because Claire and Philip, it should be explained, jump to the perfectly logical, if inaccurate, assumption that what Gilbert has done is stolen a script that they wrote and added his name to their script and then passed it off as the work of all three of them. So they fly out to Los Angeles operating on the assumption that Gilbert has stolen their script. It's only in the middle of a meeting with this producer when he starts talking about his favorite scenes from their script that they realize, oh, my God, he passed off Casablanca as our work.
Well, it raises the question.
You know, stunned and devastated.
Right. Well, I mean, it begs the question of whether any Hollywood executive could really be so dumb as not to recognize Casablanca. I mean, you've worked in this business, and I'm wondering.
Oh, I think there are no end of people in this town who would not recognize Casablanca. In fact, I heard that some wag years ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, had, you know, sent it around to development people, had changed the name and changed some of the slugs and maybe eliminated a couple of the most famous lines, and just to see what kind of script coverage Casablanca would get. And a vast number of people were fooled.
God, so the stories we hear about Hollywood, some of them are really true.
Well, I had no trouble believing it because when I came up with the idea that he would steal Casablanca, I, in fact, had never seen Casablanca. I had seen the famous scenes from it in film clips countless times, so I knew all the big moments from the movie, but I had never actually sat down and watched the entire film. So you could have fooled me just as easily if you took care to disguise the most famous dialogue from the movie. If you hear, you know, play it again, Sam or his looking at you, kid, or, this could be the start of a beautiful friendship. If I saw those lines, I'd say, wait a minute, I think that's Casablanca. I've seen those clips. But I had never actually watched the entire film until I sat down to write this book.
Has your creative experience of writing a novel, is that very different than writing a television script?
Oh, it's extremely different. It's rather gratifying. I have to say that I like the fiction writing better, if only because, first of all, your contact with your audience is one-on-one. It's very immediate. Your work isn't interpreted. It doesn't go through a designer and a director and doesn't have to be acted, which is not to say that having your work interpreted by wonderful people isn't a fantastic experience. It's just that everything that you do is only a means to an end. A script is a blueprint for something, and if a script isn't produced, it really has little reason to be. Whereas if you write a story, it's done, it's finished, and it's ready for its audience. It's ready to go out into the world.
And it's all yours. I mean, you don't have to deal with all these
other
people.
It's all yours. It's not. I mean, the nice thing about working in TV is that it's collaborative, and the nice thing about writing fiction is that it's not collaborative. I'd like to mix it up between the two of them.
Joe Keenan is an award-winning television writer and the author of the novel My Lucky Star. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Kathleen Fitzpatrick is Associate Professor of English and Media Studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. She's also the author of The Anxiety of Obsolescence, the American novel in the age of television. In her book, Fitzpatrick examines the novels of Don DeLillo and Thomas Pynchon.
Both of them write about television, though, I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in is the kinds of anxieties that they're writing about television reveals. I mean, so first of all, DeLillo in Mao Tu has a central character, Bill Gray, who is himself a novelist and a very Pynchon-esque novelist at that. He has published two novels that made an enormous splash, but then became very reclusive and has become this figure, this sort of cult figure that people are trying to find but cannot find. He's been working on his third novel for something on the order of 20 years and can't quite seem to get it right and release it. He is surrounded by figures who are drawn directly out of or draw their energy out of television. And this is all happening at a moment in the 1980s in which it appears that there has been some kind of collusion between television and terrorism, in which terrorists, particularly at this point in the Middle East, are using televisual spectacles to get their messages across. And so there's a very high-profile kidnapping in this novel of another author who is a Salman Rushdie-like figure. And this Pynchon-esque figure decides that he is going to go forth and save the day and ultimately is destroyed in this process. So we have in Mao Tu a novelist who is literally destroyed by his desire to be important in a culture that is so profoundly affected by televisual spectacles.
Wow.
At the same time, Pynchon in Vineland, which is published again in the mid-1980s, has television operating in that novel as one of the major tools used in a post-1960s fascist takeover of the U.S. government. It becomes the primary tool of pacifying and mollifying the public to keep them from paying attention to the politics that are going on around them. So there's a real recurrence throughout both of their work, both Pynchon and DeLillo, of television and the televisual audience as being dehumanized and depoliticized and leading to a kind of dangerous passivity that is contrary to everything that ostensibly the novel stands for.
But it's they both then ascribe to television enormous power.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it, a power that makes them very nervous and a power that they definitely set themselves against, that they as novelists are going to be writing against the culture.
It's not so much that they're afraid that it's going to take away their livelihood. There is this sense that somehow the novel is a force of good, writing is a force of good, and television is a force of evil. But in fact, both tell stories. How do they get past that? Or is it that they, is it the choice of stories or the way in which the stories get told?
I think in large part it is the way that the stories get told. They are clearly both very interested in narrative, but there's a way in which both of these novelists, and in my book I use them as sort of emblematic of a whole range of novelists who have these same kinds of interests, who would argue that what gets lost in moving from a culture that is fundamentally interested in the novel as the means by which narratives are transmitted to a culture that focuses on television is the use of language. That language itself, which is the thing, according to these novelists, that makes us most human, falls by the wayside in favor of a visuality that becomes a bit benumbing and misleading.
So the use of sound and image to drive story somehow is less substantive than the effort that you need to take. Because reading a novel is often descriptive of sound, descriptive of image, descriptive of story. Putting words in your way so that you then become more actively involved. Is that what they're saying, that television doesn't do those things?
I think yes. I mean, part of what they're suggesting is that the ways that a reader interacts with language are more active and more focused in dealing with print on paper than television watchers' activity in interpreting the sounds and images that come across the screen would be. There's a sense in which the word is understood by a novelist to be a more direct and honest mode of communication than is an image or a sound which somehow can lie, which is manipulable, which is...
Well, as you were talking about the ways in which television can lie, that's almost a direct quote from David Foster Wallace, another of the writers that you,
yes,
you talk about. He says, doesn't he, at some point, television lies? And it's not what he says, but my feeling as he followed up was, I'm not exactly sure how.
I think so. I mean, I think there's a difference, though, between a writer like David Foster Wallace and a writer like either Don DeLillo or Thomas Pynchon. And one of the arguments that I end up making is that it may be generational. It may simply be that Wallace was born after the point at which television had so permeated American culture until it's just in the backdrop of everything that Ryder does and knows throughout his childhood and his subsequent life, as opposed to Pynchon and DeLillo, both of whom were around as television came into American culture. Wallace's approach to television, as many other younger contemporary novelists, is more to think about what purpose it is that television serves in our lives, rather than thinking about what television does to us. Pynchon and DeLillo seem very focused on the ways that television misleads or dehumanizes or pacifies or de-individualizes us. Wallace is much more interested in particularly if you think about Infinite Jest, television as one form of addiction that's ranged alongside drugs and sports and other aspects of American culture that are being used to feed a profound void that's at the American heart. And what he's ultimately interested in is what has produced that void. Television is not to blame for it. Television is merely one of the things to which we turn in order to numb ourselves to a kind of psychic pain that we live with every day.
With all of the things that are happening with the change in television technology now, with the ability to watch video on demand, are those things going to affect not just television, they're all frightened now, but the novel as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's happening in the kinds of media convergence that we're seeing in the internet right now, and particularly in the much-hyped Web 2.0 of social network software, is that many more people are producing many more kinds of writing that are being read broadly, if not by millions of Americans, at least by thousands of Americans. And so I'm thinking, of course, about blogs at this point, that perhaps the kinds of writers who, in a previous era before the internet, would have thought what I want to write is a novel are now thinking, well, actually, I have many more modes of production that are available to me. I can write a blog, I can shoot a video and I can put it online, I can have a podcast that I produce.
Coming back to the question of television at the moment, do you think that television has had an impact on the way we read?
That's a very good question. Probably it has. There have been a lot of studies, and particularly I'm thinking about the NEH Reading at Risk study that was released last year. There have been a number of studies that suggest that people read more and more periodicals and less long-form texts, whether fiction or nonfiction. And so, I mean, I think that there's something in the pleasures of television. I mean, the pleasures of television in no small part lie in seriality, right? In the ability to come back to something week after week, in the forestalling of closure so that a narrative never really completely ends. It sort of almost ends and then it drags you back in to make sure you come back the next week. I think there's something in that desire for an ongoing but serially delivered narrative that has perhaps changed the way that we read, that fewer long novels get read anymore. Okay, I say this. On the other hand, I'm in the middle of reading Neal Stephenson's Quicksilver, which is the first of
the
three-volume Baroque trilogy. Right. So I am 400 pages into 3,000 pages worth of text. And I'm fascinated by this and also fascinated by the number of people who I know have actually read this, who are not usually readers of the big novel. So I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, yes, I want to say that clearly television has had an impact in no small part because we've got so much information coming at us from so many different directions that probably the amount of time that one has to devote to the act of reading has been reduced. But I don't think television alone can be blamed for that.
Kathleen Fitzpatrick is the author of The Anxiety of Obsolescence, the American novel in the age of television. She teaches English and media studies at Pomona College. If you'd like to comment on this program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll conclude our hour on television with a look at the groundbreaking sketch comedy of The Kids in the Hall. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You might know Dave Foley from his recent work as the host of the Bravo TV show Celebrity Poker Showdown. Or maybe you remember him as the news director on the Situation Comedy News Radio. But Dave Foley first came to attention as one-fifth of the Kids in the Hall, a sketch comedy group from Canada. The Kids in the Hall revolutionized sketch comedy from 1989 to 1994 with their television show. It aired on HBO, CBS, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. The fourth season of the Kids TV show has just been released on DVD. And to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon had the chance to talk to his fellow Canadian, Dave Foley, about the Kids in the Hall.
My line, I hardly ever get out. See, I'm an axe murderer. So I usually work indoors. You know, privacy and all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, beautiful day like today, and I'm stuck inside, you know, just chopping up this couple. I mean, a nice young couple. He's a cable installer, and she's a dentist. There aren't a lot of women dentists. I don't know why that is. Gee, I guess there's one fewer now, huh?
That's Dave Foley as the axe murderer. And that's just a sample of the smart, subversive, and surreal sketch comedy that Foley created with his four fellow Canadians, the Kids in the Hall. The Kids in the Hall took their name from the Jack Benny program. Benny used to say that some of his jokes came from young writers hanging around the studio, who he described as the Kids in the Hall. But that is about as obvious as the kids get in terms of their comedy influences, as Dave Foley told me.
Our way of honoring the stuff that we really like, people like Python and SCTV, was to try to not be like them at all. They did what they did really well, so we had to try and find a new way of doing it. We didn't want to feel like we were ever copying the people we liked. So, you know, in that regard, yeah, there was a conscious desire to be different from the comedy that influenced us. But more than anything, it was just that we wanted to do stuff that didn't bore us, you know? We just, you know, a lot of the comedy that was going on when we started out seemed pretty tame and boring. It was all part of the punk rock days. We just wanted to see if there was a way to shake up what sketch comedy was a little.
How did the kids decide what material made for good sketch comedy?
Each of us felt like the other four guys could make us laugh harder than anybody else. And so if we came up with an idea that made them laugh, then that was all we needed to know. Even then, it was, you know, if it made like two or three of us laugh, that's all that mattered. Sometimes if it made all five of us laugh, then we really knew we were onto something. That rarely happened. We never approached it as though we were ever going to succeed. The Kids in the Hall was a place to just do exactly what we wanted. And by doing that, we sort of got further and further down the road. So by the time we got to TV, it just was our habit to pretty much only pay attention to ourselves and what we wanted to do.
The Kids in the Hall spent 3 years developing their work in front of live audiences at the Rivoli Theatre in Toronto during the mid-80s. Then their fellow Canadian Lorne Michaels, the creator of Saturday Night Live, discovered the kids. Michaels got them a television deal. Dave Foley says that there's more creative freedom in doing comedy for TV as opposed to comedy for film.
It's freer not because the people that run it are any more liberal or respectful of talent, but because the schedules are so tight that there's far less time for people to come in and ruin things. Once you've got a TV show running, it's very hard for the network to really keep track of what you're doing.
Yeah, because you're so busy feeding the beast and the insatiable appetite every week.
Yeah, so as long as it fills up the 22 minutes, a lot of the time things can slide and you can do much more intelligent stuff on TV. We had more freedom doing the Kids in the Hall show than we had doing the Kids in the Hall movie.
Brain Candy.
Yeah, when we did Brain Candy, it was really the first time in our career that we had people from the outside trying to tell us what to do, and we had to get approval from people when we wanted to change stuff.
Are there any other advantages to doing short-form sketch comedy for television?
Well, you definitely don't have to worry about why should we like this character, which is, I think is the one question that destroys more comedy than any other question that's ever asked in a meeting, is why should we care about this person? That usually leads to sort of a ham-fisted bit of pathos being tacked on to every character ever put into a movie, where you'll have a character who's a complete ass for 90 minutes, but then at the last second does one nice thing. There's definitely that pressure. And in a sketch, you don't have to worry about that. You're allowed to do characters that aren't likable.
The kids created an incredible cast of characters, most of whom are very likable. All five of the kids are very gifted actors. I'd go so far as to describe them as comedy chameleons who vanish into their characters. This commitment to character is one of the things that makes the kids' comedy so distinctive and so funny. Two of my favorite kids' characters are Lex and Dean, played by Foley and Kevin MacDonald. In the first Lex and Dean sketch, things get out of hand when Dean doesn't return Lex's video.
You were supposed to meet me at the restaurant at 8 o'clock. Where were you?
Slipped my mind. But I feel horrible about the whole thing.
No! I don't want to hear it! You're the king of empty promises, you know that, man? What we're gonna do now is we're gonna go to your house and we're gonna get my stuff, understand?
I have to take my friend home first. But I'll tell you what. I'll bring your mahogany video. The Godfather video. The Paul Simon tape. A bottle of scotch. And a written apology. I'll meet you in a half hour.
Okay.
Sorry I had to crack the whip. Forget it.
Shouldn't you have told him I live in Winnipeg?
Slipped my mind.
The character's sort of based on Paul Bellini, originally, who you may have seen in A Towel on our show. And Paul was also a writer on the show. So the attitude was kind of Paul's, like, overwhelmingly relaxed approach to everything. He would just be very quiet and still when everyone else was yelling and screaming. That came from Paul Bellini. And the King of Empty Promises, part of that character is Kevin. Basically, that's Kevin is the King of Empty Promises. He will, anything Kevin tells you he's definitely going to do, you can just count on him never doing it.
Which explains why I'm still waiting for my Paul Simon album and bottle of scotch.
Yeah. I have a truckload of things he owes me that he's promised. And then my character was just basically, we had to come up with a straight man for him, and I just sort of came up with that character.
Yeah, and it's a great character. They're both great characters, and the relationship between them is great and very funny. And I've always wondered, Dave, if you were originally going to play the more stoic part of Dean and if Kevin was originally going to play the more frazzled Lex, because it seems to me that that's one of the things that makes these characters so funny. It seems that you and Kevin are both playing each other's roles, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, Dean is more of a deadpan character. I'm more known for that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And definitely when we were doing it, we were conscious of the fact that we were kind of reversing our roles. Actually, it's two of my favorite characters to play on the show as well.
Dave Foley told me how the kids in the hall developed their material.
Scott and Mark would almost always start from a character. There'd be a character, especially with Mark, a voice that he has that he wants to try out, and then he tries to find a scene to put the character in. Bruce was much more about having sort of a weird idea, and he'll like want to explore this odd idea. Kevin and I were much more about, we usually like to know what the hook of the sketch was, and then once we knew what the hook of the sketch was, then we would figure out the characters and the dialogue after that. Mm-hmm. Kevin and I had a sketch called Citizen Kane, which was just about two guys sitting in a diner, and one of them's trying to remember the name of a movie, and the movie's obviously Citizen Kane, but he won't admit it. However, many times his friend tells him, no, that movie was Citizen Kane. He just won't acknowledge it. Basically, once we had the hook of somebody who just won't accept when the information's given to him, that sketch took about as long to write as it took us to perform it.
It's Citizen Kane.
Psycho.
No, it's Psycho.
No, it isn't Psycho.
It's Psycho.
No, it is Psycho. Is this about a motel owner who's crazy and kills a woman in a shower?
No, I just told you. It's about this newspaper tycoon. He had a sled named Rosebud, and they're all trying
to figure
it out.
Then I guess it wasn't Psycho, was it?
No, it wasn't Psycho.
It was Citizen Kane?
No, it was Angela Angels.
No, it wasn't The Trouble with Angels, no. That's a Haley Mills vehicle. That's not even close.
The Front Page.
Oh, The Front Page is a comedy. Did you laugh once?
No.
Then I guess it wasn't The Front Page, was it?
Well, what the hell was it then?
The kids in the hall often played female characters and were very convincing in drag, especially Foley.
First off, that's one of the few things the group never fought about, was that I was the best looking in drag. It really came about as a matter of necessity. When we started out, we wound up with five guys in the group, and we tried to get some women to join the group early on when we were in the clubs. A couple of women came in and did shows with us, but then they would usually wind up going off and getting hired somewhere because women doing comedy were at more of a premium. So we were left with no women in the group, and the only way we could write about anything other than just guys hanging out was to play the women. And then once we were doing it, we made a very conscious choice that we never wanted to get a laugh because we were playing women. We wanted the female characters to just be accepted as characters in the scenes. We didn't want, like, Milton Berle laughs. And I got to say, to be fair, part of the inspiration for the way we did women actually did come from Python, but not from their TV show. It actually, in the movie The Meaning of Life, especially it's the, I think, the scene where death is at the dinner table. Michael Palin and Terry Jones, I think, are women in the scene. And their women are just dead-on accurate.
One of Foley's most dead-on accurate female characters is a hooker named Jocelyn.
What would you say if aliens came down and tried to pick us up?
Would they pay us in our own money?
No, in alien money.
No, I would not fall for that again. No.
Okay. I would.
The kids often had creative differences about what should make it into a show and what shouldn't. Foley says there was an upside to the yelling, the fighting, and the anger.
Definitely having to go through the group and get notes from everyone, that definitely had an upside. You know, as a group, we were very good at giving notes. Sometimes we'd be way off base, but mostly you'd get good notes. And most of the time, you knew if you could get support for a piece from at least two other guys, you could probably get it done. Rarely would you get all five people on board. Everyone would have some piece where they, oh, I hate that sketch. I can't believe we're doing that sketch. In retrospect, we were mostly wrong about those.
It's been more than a decade since the kids in the hall created their innovative TV sketch comedy, but their work seems as fresh as ever. Why?
I don't know. No? I'm glad to hear it does. It's hard for me to judge. I guess part of it was that we were consciously, for the most part, not topical. There's not a lot of pop culture references in our stuff, and there's not a lot of flat-on satire of current events. So none of the jokes require that you're versed in whatever happened in the news that day. You know, our stuff is much more about how people interact, and if there's politics in it, it's usually expressed in the characters and in more of a domestic situation.
Yeah, there were a lot of sketches that involved families and also a lot of sketches that took on big business, corporate types, business executives.
Yeah, I think family, because I don't think any of us had a good family. None of us came from good families. We all came from pretty messed up childhoods. And business, because it was a mystery to us.
Dave Foley is an actor, writer, and a member of the Canadian sketch comedy group, The Kids in the Hall. He spoke with his fellow Canadian, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. The Kids in the Hall recently created 90 minutes of new material, which they tested in front of live audiences in Los Angeles. Dave Foley says there's a chance the kids may reunite for another tour or to do another film. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for the program number 64B, TV or not TV. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Special thanks to engineer Megan Manning.
PRI, Public Radio International.